Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Public Safety, January 25th, 2007, Hearing Room 170, 3 p.m.
The Subcommittee on Public Safety, Joint Committee on Ways and Means to order. Mr. Wilson, would you like to make any comments?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, we have informational hearings or overviews for the state police, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and the military department today. And I just start off other than to note two things. There's a press release underneath your agenda that has to do with the first speaker. And I also urge who's ever at the mic to make sure the mic is close to you or talk loudly, or you'll get a dirty scowl from the from our committee assistant who can't hear that. So I urge you to do that. So the state police are up first.
And Mr. McLean, I understand you've been appointed to this new position as superintendent, and we wanted to congratulate you. We're very excited to have you in that position.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hopefully I end the day on a positive and not fumble through this.
You're going to do great. Ready when you are.
Volume okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Timothy McLean, your superintendent of the Oregon State Police.
Is that the first time you've been able to say that?
Yes, Representative.
Sounds good.
I had to go back and change some of this. I'm also coming up on my 28th anniversary as a state trooper, which I'm extremely proud of. Also present in the room and representing the department is Monica Brown and Greg Williford. Thank you for the opportunity to give a brief overview of the department and the men and women who provide an important public service for the citizens of Oregon. Before you is a notebook which contains the department's mission, statutory authority, organizational charts, field office maps, budget summary, position history, all that stuff to help you get your job done. I hope you find the information useful. As we move forward the next month, we'll work with your staff to fill that notebook with more additional information to help you through your important decision making. Okay. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to provide the committee with more of a nuts and bolts approach as to who we are and what we do. I won't reference too many items in the notebook except for the organizational chart on page 5 and the map on page 6. First, just to give you a brief history of the Oregon State Police. In 1931, not in this present building because I believe the Capitol burned somewhere in the middle 30s, but people gathered in this building, let's say, to talk about a statewide law enforcement agency. The governor wanted a police organization modeled after several state police departments on the East Coast. I've done some reading, and I understand there was a little bit of heated discussion, which I'm sure that's never happened in here before. The bill creating the department was passed through the Senate in February 1931, and the House approved it in March of 1931. The bill consolidated activities performed by the State Highway Commission, the Traffic Division from the Secretary of State's office, the State Fire Marshal, and the Fish and Game Commission. On August 1, 1931, Oregon hired 95 state police officers and gave them full police powers. 1939, the first crime lab was established and located at the University of Oregon Med School in Portland. Next major change in 1993, legislature formally consolidated the organizations of Law Enforcement Data Systems, better known as LEDS, Emergency Management, State Fire Marshal's Office, and Boxing and Wrestling Commission within the department. Senator. In 1995, Medical Examiner's Office and Criminal Justice Services were merged into the department. So today, we're an agency with a much broader public safety responsibility. The state police is much more than, I'd like to say, the badge or the campaign hat. Besides the changes in language, our mission remains pretty much the same as it was in 1931, and that is to provide professional service to the citizens of Oregon and perform that in cooperation with our criminal justice partners. Now I refer to page 5, which is the organizational chart I mentioned, and moving to left to right, we first have the professional standards and training section. In this section is our internal affairs unit, risk management, and our training section. When I bring up training, this would be, if you don't mind, I'll stop here for a second, is that I've been on 28 years, and before that, state police trained over at Redmond. But for at least 28 years, we've trained state police officers at a separate academy at Camp Rialea. I'm excited that in February, next week actually, we're going to start state police recruits at the new police academy here in Salem. And that is a good thing. Mr. Minnis is here to give you a report on the academy. They have put together an excellent program out there. With your support, that is a great facility. And our people are going to be able to train alongside city and county officers. And those are the people that they rely on each other for backup. So I'm looking really forward to training. Office of Budget and Finance is Monica Brown's shop, which is up next. And on days like yesterday, you knock before you enter, because we all have our days. Both of those sections report directly to the superintendent's office. Next up, you have the two bureaus. First is the Operations Bureau, which I like to call as the law enforcement branch of the department. And then you have the Support Bureau. And that's the bureau that basically keeps the department running. And for the most part, that is a bureau that those divisions support all criminal justice agencies in the state. In a minute, I'll come back and describe in more detail those services to you. But I'd like to, in completing the chart, we'll talk about the Office of Emergency Management, State Fire Marshal's Office, and the Criminal Justice Services. In 2004, these divisions were moved under executive order and made part of the new Office of Homeland Security. In 2006, the Military Department of State Police signed a memorandum of understanding, whereas the military would have operational oversight of the emergency management and criminal justice services, and state police would have budget oversight. The State Fire Marshal's Office returned to the department and reports directly to the superintendent's office. A legislative proposal is before you this session to permanently merge emergency management and portions of criminal justice services into the military department. General Caldwell is here and may want to speak more about the role of emergency management and criminal justice services, but I will give you a short version of what they do. Emergency management is responsible for the governor's statewide emergency services system. They help state and local agencies plan, prepare for, respond to, and recover from a disaster. They are located in the Military Reserve Building on State Street, and in the event of a disaster, can quickly ramp up a state emergency operations center. Criminal Justice Services serve as the state's administrative agency for federal criminal justice and homeland security grant programs. Grants are awarded to state and local agencies to address domestic and family violence prevention, juvenile violence prevention, and homeland security strategies. Back to the State Fire Marshal's Office. Their role is to provide for the protection of citizens, their property, and the environment from fires and hazardous materials. They lead a statewide system of community-based fire prevention programs and mobilize local fire departments for all risk emergencies. We have 18 regional fire marshal deputies stationed throughout the state working with your local fire departments. And back to the map in this case, you can see where those are located around the state. They assist local fire departments with fire code applications, fire cause investigations, education, and prevention programs. Also in the Fire Marshal's Office is Education Division. They provide smoke alarms for local fire departments, insulation campaigns. They also partner with insurance companies to address the smoke alarm issue and provide news media with fire prevention materials. State Fire Marshal's Office also oversees 15 regional hazardous materials teams that are located across the state, and they use local fire department personnel. They provide professional professionally train and equip the firefighters to cover the entire state for chemical incidents, had to get there. That's hopefully the only one. Sorry. Fire Marshal's office staff are also helping at the local level to facilitate planning involving local fire departments, law enforcement, medical and other agencies, enabling communities to handle chemical response incidents. Fire Marshal's office also has three incident management response teams that were developed in conjunction with local fire departments to keep firefighters and communities safe. They also, in the last several years, developed urban search and rescue teams comprised of local fire departments and are trained and equipped to assist communities throughout the state in the event of a major disaster. Now I'll get back to the bureaus, and I'll start with support. The Forensic Service Division is comprised of the Forensic Laboratories and an Implied Consent Unit. Forensic Laboratories are located throughout the state in Bend, Central Point, Ontario, Pendleton, Portland, and Springfield. The Implied Consent Unit is located in Portland. The labs examine evidence in forensic disciplines of chemistry, DNA, firearms, tool marks, trace evidence, latent prints, and question documents, just to name a few. One of their primary responsibility then, after they analyze this evidence, is to testify in court. As Oregon's only full-service forensic laboratory system, 90% of the division's work is for law enforcement other than state police. Employees respond upon request to process major crime scenes to collect and preserve evidence and aid in the reconstruction of criminal acts. They work closely with major crime teams around the state. And I, personal experience, I'll see the TV programs, and for the most part, the officer out on the street or the detectives out on the street, for most crimes, they gather the evidence themselves. And then, depending on the type of evidence, send it to the crime lab that may have the equipment to process it. But at the same time, as what I was speaking to, is that crime lab personnel are available at a phone call to respond anywhere in the state to help local agencies process a crime scene. Now, again, the evidence doesn't necessarily go directly to the closest crime lab, because to be the most efficient, and this equipment is pretty spendy, there's certain labs are responsible for certain evidence processing. So that, depending on who has the equipment, that's where the evidence could go to. I also mentioned the implied consent unit. Oregon's primary breath testing instrument is the Intoxilizer 8000. Now, this was funded from you folks last session, where we got these new instruments out to the local agencies. And the unit was responsible, and they're always responsible, for the certification, servicing, training, and expert testimony in support of these instruments, which are utilized by Oregon's more than 5,000 sworn police officers. State Medical Examiner's Office. Oregon has had a statewide medical examiner's office for 40 years. Medical examiner is appointed to the position and is always a physician. They are experts investigating homicides, suicides, drug overdose, and accidents. We currently have 5 medical examiners that perform 1,200 to 1,400 autopsies a year. Medical examiners testify in court on a routine basis and teach medical students, physicians, police officers, and attorneys in a variety of programs. They also oversee all deputy medical examiners in county programs and on a daily basis give advice and direction to investigators and the medical community. Our medical examiners asked me to note that while they may not be as glamorous as CSI, they run a professional death investigation program that the citizens of Oregon can trust and be proud of. Information Management Division. There's 4 sections under this division. I'll go through them here briefly. The Enterprise Service section is the department's computer shop and or information technology unit. Section maintains our various applications and supports our desktop computers. The Wireless Communication section is basically the department's two-way radio shop and is responsible for maintaining the department's 128 remote radio sites in addition to 890 mobile and 920 portable radio units for our troopers out in the field. The Criminal Justice Services Section is better known as the Law Enforcement Data System, or LEDS. This section serves every criminal justice agency in the state and is the sole source provider of access to the Oregon computerized criminal history information and the FBI's National Crime Information System. The law enforcement message switch maintained by this section connects to users to a multitude of mission-critical computer systems. What I mean by that is if the officer out on the street, on a traffic stop, they can, on the radio, make one call to dispatch and in one check can find out whether the person's suspended, on probation, a registered sex offender, wanted, or listed missing person, at the same time find out if the car is stolen or an item in the car is stolen, such as a gun. This section is also responsible for the operation of the Oregon Uniform Crime Reporting Program and staffing and operation of the Consolidated 24/7 Emergency Response System, which is OARS, and the LEDS Operation Center, which serves as a sole contact for state agency response to hazardous incidents. The Identification Services Section is the state's ID Bureau. This section serves every criminal justice agency in the state and is a sole provider of the following services. I might stop here for a second. This section is located out on Portland Road, and if you ever have an opportunity to visit it, there's a lot of great people that work there. The facility is not very big, and for the caseload that they have, they work shifts. So what I'm saying is that one person empties a chair on day shift, somebody else comes in right behind them on swing shift to continue the workload. And sometimes we forget they're out there doing that difficult job. They maintain the computerized criminal history, which is called a CCH. It's a record unit that collects and maintains arrests and court activities as reported by local and state law enforcement. They have the APHIS, which is the automated fingerprint identification system, which basically, if you arrest somebody, you can immediately send it in if you don't know who they are, and it'll match up and identify who the person is. They do public fingerprinting, mainly for employment purposes. They do the firearms instant check system, and they do backgrounds for concealed handgun permits. Administrative Service Division maintain compliance with employment laws and the four labor agreements with management of the department's human resources, labor relations, contract administration, negotiations, payroll services, employee benefits. They take care of our facilities. They take care of contracting and purchasing. The bottom line is these are the people behind the scene that ensure paychecks go out on time, they pay the bills, and they keep the cars running. Game and Enforcement ensures the fairness, honesty, integrity, and security of the Oregon State Lottery and Tribal Gaming Centers. Regarding our work with the Oregon tribal governments, it's a partnership. The tribes are the primary regulators of their gaming operations. The role of the state police is to work with the tribes to ensure that the security interests of the state as found in each gaming compact are upheld. The Operations Bureau consists of the Patrol Division. Patrol Division provides uniform patrol and law enforcement services on nearly 8,000 miles state and interstate highways. And their basic mission is to save lives. And they do that by a number of different ways. But one is in crash reduction. That's one of their goals. And they do that through high visibility and high contact traffic enforcement. They assist motorists. They remove impaired drivers. They work on commercial motor vehicle enforcement, seat belt enforcement and education, highway work zone patrols. And on each and every stop, our troopers are trained to work towards crime reduction by looking beyond the reason for the stop for evidence of criminal activity. The best part, though, of this job is, as people have heard me say before, is they help people. A week doesn't go by that seems like we get a letter into the office, and I got one just 2 days ago. I'll give you a quick example, and these are the ones I'm proud of, is that a couple was going from Portland to John Day to attend a funeral service. West of John Day, they broke down. First came a fish and wildlife officer headed out to his work zone. He called a patrol troop over. They found out they couldn't fix the car on the spot, so the patrol trooper first took them to an auto parts store to try to fix it. That didn't work. They came back, ended up taking both of them to the funeral, got a tow truck in, got the car moved into town, got the car repaired, and got them back to their car. That's the kind of stuff I'm proud of these troopers do every day. Not on the chart is, I'll just mention it briefly, is under patrol division, although the budget piece shows up under administration, is our special operations. And under that is the command center, better known as the dispatch centers. These people are working 24/7 to take care of the public and our troopers. When I started in 1979, the department had 26 dispatch points. Over 16 years, we've refined how we do business there. We went down from the original 26 down to 2. One is located here in Salem. The other is located in Central Point. On the average, we have call takers, and then we have dispatchers in here in the centers. But on the average, they handle 200,000 calls for service a year, and they take care of troopers out there while they're out on traffic stops, and that is roughly 200,000, same number, a year. Also in this section, we have SWAT, Special Weapons and Tactics Team. They're patrol troopers. This is secondary duties for them. They have additional training. They're ready 24/7 to respond anywhere in the state. And I believe it's closer to two-thirds of their calls a year are in response to local agencies. We also have the mobile response team, which is troopers, which additional training that they can handle large crowd events, such as a state fair. But most of their calls are in response to local communities to handle, such as the Seaside Spring Break, the Sand Fest down, I believe, in Reedsport. That's where most of their calls are. The Criminal Investigation Division, better known as the Detective Division, they are working in your community, statewide, supporting law enforcement agencies and various federal criminal justice agencies. They participate in local major crime teams, interagency drug task force, and fire investigation teams. Their day, any one of them, can go from a multi-jurisdictional drug trafficking case, sex abuse case, large-scale fraud cases, working with an interagency team on a major crime such as a homicide. They do follow-up work for cases generated by patrol and fish and wildlife. They do the criminal investigations at all state correctional facilities. They also conduct criminal investigations for various state government agencies and sensitive criminal investigations that may involve public officials. Some detectives provide a specialized service that local agencies can't provide, such as analyzing computers used in crimes, arson explosives investigations, and polygraph examinations. The Sex Offender Registration Unit, which manages the database for registered sex offenders, and the Investigative Report Section, which responds to public records requests, is also located in this division. As you all know, meth is having a huge impact on our communities. The department is committed and focused on helping address this issue. With your support, this last year and a half, we placed detectives and communities to focus on the methamphetamine manufacturing and trafficking. These detectives are working alongside local and federal law enforcement. In the past year and a half, patrol troopers and detectives have teamed up to combat the flow of narcotics being transported on our highways. With the help of Criminal Division 4 drug detection, canines were trained and have patrolled patrol troopers on our interstate and state highways. A fifth canine is in training and will soon join the ranks. In 2006, just a few numbers, and this was actually the result of the two canines because the additional two weren't up and running yet, but they seized 23 pounds of meth, 265 pounds of marijuana, 5 pounds of cocaine, and $850,000 in currency. Fish and Wildlife Division. This division, whose primary duties are to protect Oregon natural resources, ensuring that the Oregon remains a great place to live and raise our families in. Their primary role is to enforce laws pertaining to commercial fishing and sport fishing, hunting, and the environment. Oregon is one of two states where fish and wildlife officers have full police powers as part of a state police agencies, allowing them to enforce all state laws, including traffic and criminal laws. Oftentimes, they are the only law enforcement official in remote areas of Oregon. Our Fish and Wildlife Division prides itself on the partnerships they have developed with other state and federal agencies, most notably the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Also on your chart, you'll see that we have region commands. Region commands are located in the three areas of the state, northwest, south, and on the east side. They're commanded by captains whose job is to maintain the standards of the department, work with local agencies so they can get their job done, and command the field force in a time of emergency. Also, you will see that we have 14 area commands located in the major cities and towns. These are commanded by a lieutenant. And what we call post, or used to be the outpost, are located in the smaller communities, and they are commanded by sergeants. Last on your chart for the organizational chart on, under operations, should be the Office of Public Safety. This section reports to the Criminal Investigation Division. They are committed to the protection of Oregon citizens from acts of terrorism through coordination with our state, federal, and local partners. One detective is assigned to the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. We have another detective assigned over the Oregon Department of Justice Terrorism Intelligence and Threat Assessment Network. And the third detective is also at the Department of Justice investigating acts of domestic terrorism. Just to give you a current snapshot of the budget, and this is the 2005-07 through the November e-board, totals roughly $534 million, made up of 34% of general fund, 1% of lottery fund, 28% of other funds, 37% of federal funds. More than 70% of the general fund is in support of patrol, criminal, and forensics. Other fund sources are used to fund more than 50% of the operations of fish and wildlife, gaming, state fire marshal, and emergency management. Grants received by the Criminal Justice Service Division and Oregon Emergency Management account for more than 90% of all federal grants received. I'd also like to bring your attention in the book that may be useful to you. There is two letters in there that are response letters to a legislative work group that has been meeting to find solutions for adequate training for patrol. Some of you served on that group, but for those who have not seen the letters, in short, it answers questions as to the staffing levels in patrol, expected outcomes, and objectives. Also in there is a telephone survey conducted in October of 2006, updating data on the number of state police and highway patrol troopers nationwide per 100,000 population and the United States highway mile. In closing, for my comments, I'd just like to say that I'm extremely proud of the work that the men and women of the Oregon State Police do on a daily basis. They do this work at times through adverse conditions, but they always come right back. And the three words that are on the front of your notebook, they always, it's pride, loyalty, and dedication. I know you're proud of them. They do a great job for the citizens of Oregon. And I'm proud to be their superintendent. As your new superintendent, I will commit to building strong relationships with local sheriffs and chiefs of police so that we can provide you top-notch public safety service to the citizens of this state and the visitors who come here to see this great state. I pledge that to you, to the best of my abilities, I will work with you so you can achieve your goals of helping people in this state. We look forward to coming back in a few weeks and having further discussions regarding the department's performance measures and budget outcomes. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll close and answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. McLean. Questions? Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim, I was talking to you before. I think in the ranks things are pretty decent, but I have some real concerns with administration and things that are happening in my district. You've got one sexual harassment lawsuit filed already, and well, maybe it's not a sexual harassment suit, it's a retaliatory lawsuit filed in Baker City. I believe there's another situation in my district in La Grande that's a retaliatory. Retaliatory harassment suit wherein the area commanders or the folks in administration, I think, have not handled the situation very well. And it's mainly the commanders, and the alleged statement anyway in my district is one of the area commanders are there allegedly told one of my or one of the patrol guys that you're one chromosome short of being a good trooper, you're a Bible thumper, and I'm going to be driving your pickup before this is all done. And so I don't have any problem with the troopers on the road. I have some problems with what's going on in the administration, and how do you handle all that? You know, if you get sued, where does that money come from? How much is it? Are you under the state limit? You know, there's just some issues there that things are not all rosy in the state police, from my viewpoint.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I find it difficult to answer some of that. Those are open cases. What I can say is this. 28 years on the job, I know that state police has had issues in their management ranks. That is one reason why I stepped up a number of years ago and came on board on the management ranks. I prided myself in treating everybody on the department fair, with respect, but at the same time, we have standards to uphold. And I think the public expects that of us. We do good and thorough investigations when it involves our people, and I think for the most part, the outcome is correct. I'd be more than happy outside this environment to probably go in further detail.
I just suppose it's not really the detail of that. It's just, I think there's a major problem. I mean, and then I have a minor problem where I have a constituent that said he was not well treated by one of your folks. his words are, there's a cover-up going on. And you allege that there's you know, good investigations. No, from my viewpoint, I'm seeing a trend where I don't see the good investigations going. And the retaliatory aspect of this thing, I think, is just not fair to the troopers. And so I'm going to be pretty critical from that viewpoint.
No response, but perhaps if you would like to provide through the LFO staff some information on the appeals process or complaint process, that might be helpful to the committee when a citizen has a complaint against a trooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like some help in understanding a few topics, and if this is something that you're going to be bringing back to us in the future when we get more specific, I'm happy to talk about it on the appropriate day when it's on the agenda. Otherwise, I'd like some more information on the restructuring that you mentioned with regard to the military department, Homeland Security, emergency response. I'd like to know more about that, a little more detail about the history and what we will accomplish and what will be improved, what the costs would be accomplishing this, and how we will see the changes at the street level, you might say. What sort of difference will we notice?
I would like to hear more about from the fire marshal's office about fireworks. It's been one of my interests because in the past I have represented a part of a city which was at times in extreme danger of urban wildfire. So I'd like to hear more about fireworks and also just understand where water safety fits into either your activities or other departments.
feel free to comment a minute on each topic.
I'm sorry?
A minute on each topic, perhaps.
Or at the appropriate time.
Well, if I may, I think it'd be probably, we could probably bring you more detailed information back at a later date, along with some written material.
Thank you. Thanks. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the issues that is going to be coming up this session is stability of funding for the state. There's a dedicated funding source, which y'all used to have before 1980 when you were taken out of the Highway Trust Fund. During the recession, there were troopers cut, and during that time, the point was made by many people inside state police and outside that we were throwing a lot of well-trained officers up into the embrace of Washington State and other places who got good officers because of our cuts, and we had made the expenditure and the training. Can you just give us kind of a sense of how much training a new officer has and how long that takes and how you basically train them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, in short, as I mentioned earlier, the basic police officer starts out with 16 weeks of training. We also provide additional training on top of that in some of the areas that state police are responsible for, and that's crash investigation. We also have first aid, those type of issues. Once they leave the training academy, then they have a training coach, training officer, that they spend time with. Normally it's roughly 3 months, unless the person has previous law enforcement experience. And then from that, you have the yearly mandatory training. We bring them up to speed on whether it's firearms, defense tactics. I could get you the exact numbers for that. But there's a considerable amount of cost and hours that are put towards bringing an officer up to speed to the time that they leave what we call out on their first solo patrol, which is after that period of time they spend with a training officer. And then after that, most of our officers then specialize in some other such as drug recognition officer or expert. They may go back for further training on crash investigation. So we lose that too.
What else? Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. And congratulations on the new position.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, as the transfer and Mr. Minnis comes forward, just remind members that we'll help you if you wish to do any type of ride-alongs that you may find useful, or you can contact state police directly. I would also encourage you, because I'm not sure if there'll be time as part of the subcommittee, to take a tour of the Portland Crime Lab. It's relatively new, and if you have the stomach, the Office of Medical Examiner is in the same building. It's probably good to at least visit their facility. Don't have to go in depth into the freezers or anything.
It's much nicer than the old one.
Yes, it's no longer a funeral home in Northeast Portland.
And, Mr. Chair, while we're making pitches, I would also like to recommend the InstaCheck Firearms Checkup Center out in Portland Road. It's a very efficient operation. They do a great job out there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Doug, LFO staff,
yeah.
Could we take a check on that the training piece? That we could request the training piece, because it was my recollection that in the last session we moved the training from either 16 or 18 weeks to the minimum of 22 weeks.
Mr. Chair, and I think Mr. Minnis may get into this a little bit, but the basic law enforcement training for local police had been 10 weeks. It's now been expanded to 16 weeks, has just started a 16-week curriculum. The state police had done theirs separately, which had lasted 20 weeks. I can't remember the 22 weeks. The state police, now they will be attending the basic 6 weeks that DPSST offers, and then probably having 6 to 8 weeks of training in addition to that on either. It's likely before and after that training, specifically to state police. But the core training will now be done by DPSST.
Before we get started, I wanted to ask a question. Actually, Senator Minnis can answer this, or Mr. McLean. The burn grants, are they administered through the Criminal Justice Service Division, or do you know where those are overseen? Okay. And is that going to continue for the near future, even despite the consolidation? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, because Representative Nathanson had a couple questions around the reorg. There is a bill, and the governor's budget assumes a transfer of the Office of Emergency Management and the Homeland Security-related grants to the military department. There are a couple grants dealing with domestic abuse that will be transferred to DOJ or Justice, and then the remaining, I don't think the burn grant exists anymore, actually, from the federal government. It's been replaced by a block grant, if I'm not mistaken, will be continued to be responsibility of state police.
Okay. That's good information. Thank you. Mr. Minnis, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is John Minnis. I'm the Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. It's my pleasure to be here this afternoon. I do want to introduce Ms. Janine Hahn, who's the lady seated behind me, who's the agency legislative liaison. The agency is privileged to have her come into our employ. She's formerly with the McMinnville School District and formerly with, I believe, Woodburn Fire Department, Woodburn School District. And so if there are any mistakes in the materials, I'll ship them back to her. No, I'm just kidding. She does a remarkable job. What we have provided for you today, and I'm going to talk relatively fast because I understand we've been given about 15 to 20 minutes to give our presentation. We'll try to stay as close to that as we can so we don't tempt your frustration. We have provided a matrix of services, which is just a quick guide to kind of show you some of the services that we provide and under what circumstance. You can look at that at your leisure to see, in essence, what the various functions of the agency are. I've also provided a brief copied portion which shows the board and policy committee directory with the various names of the members of those committees. Keep in mind that does change from time to time. The board chair, Bob Tardif, just recently resigned, or actually retired, to be a new appointment through the governor's process. We've also provided a brief handout, which is basically a pamphlet that's been designed for public dissemination for tours and people coming to the agency to understand a little bit quicker what we're all about. Again, you can look at that at your leisure. If I can, I'll move right into my presentation. And before that, I do that, I want to try to respond to Representative Hannah's question. The issue of 22 weeks, 22 weeks last session was and is and continues to be the national average for basic training programs throughout the United States. Oregon moved from 10 weeks to 16 weeks, and there's a current and ongoing controversy among practitioners in the state of Oregon, including sheriffs and chiefs of police, who do believe that the longer and period of time is more adequate to the purpose and the necessity of training at the local level, although there are different puts and takes with regard to how that might be implemented. I want to go over the DPSST mission. DPSST mission is to promote excellence in public safety by delivering quality training. That's one larger part of our budget, and by developing and upholding professional standards. That's an increasingly important part of what we do, and I'll talk about that a little bit more as we move along. The vision of the agency, DPSST will be a leader in developing skilled, ethical public safety professionals who are respected in their communities as they work to ensure that Oregonians are safe and secure where they live, go to school, work, and play. Since I've become the director of the agency, in a series of town halls, we've developed a set of values that the agency has agreed to live by. Those values are listed on my page 3. It would be unnumbered, I think, in your version. Integrity, following the highest ethical standards in working relationships, practices, and decisions. Excellence, dedicated to the highest quality, both in our individual actions and as an organization. 3, customer service, working proactively to meet the needs of our constituents, stakeholders, and one another. Respect, regarding others with honor and valuing their varied roles, contributions, and viewpoints. Accountability, understanding that we are responsible to constituents, stakeholders, and one another in our everyday work and in pursuing our mission. Communication, speaking and listening openly, honestly, and consistently to further our mission and to build trust within our relationships. And employee development, committed to developing as a well-trained, competent, and reliable workforce that abides by the organization's values, is empowered for personal and professional growth, and is recognized for service to constituents, stakeholders, and one another. I'll now shift into a brief history of the department. The origin of the department began in 1958 with the Oregon-Washington Lawmen's Association, who got together as some progressive individuals who thought it might be a nice idea to train officers. They began that proposal, and in 1961, House Bill 1590 was created, was passed by the Oregon Legislature, creating the Board on Police Standards and Training, setting minimum standards for law enforcement in Oregon. They began a 2-week police training academy at Camp Withicum in Clackamas County, which was expanded to 4 weeks in 1967. And I apologize that the 7 was dropped off in your copy. In 1968 to 1969, the legislature made basic police training and certification mandatory in Oregon and granted BPST the ability to revoke certifications once issued. In the 1970s to the 1980s, the Police Academy expanded to 7 weeks and moved to Monmouth, Oregon, the campus of Western Oregon University. Polygraph licensing took effect, and the BPST started more types of training, including advanced officer training, parole and probation officers training was included, corrections officer training, and dispatch training included. In 1987, House Bill 2087 established the Criminal Fines and Assessment Account, otherwise known as CFAA. I believe the committee has had a prior discussion or presentation on CFAA. In the 1990s, the agency's name was changed to BPSST, representing the diversified constituent base. It stands for the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training. Established the Public Safety Memorial Fund and started telecommunications EMD or emergency medical dispatch training, added fire training and certification program to the agency along with private security licensing program. In 1997, BPSST changed and became a full department of the state of Oregon, now becoming the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. So we really have two entities within our the organization. You have the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training and the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training. In the 2000s, the legislature, and it began way back in 1997, constructed the Oregon Public Safety Academy, which is located at 4190 Almsville Highway Southeast in Salem, Oregon, and added private investigators licensing program to the agency, formerly the Oregon Board of Investigators. And we have just started the 16-week Basic Police Training Academy this January. We have a first class in. Second class is coming in February. I believe we have 11 OSP troopers who will be part of that basic training program. I do want to thank Superintendent Tim McLean for his comments about the cooperation between the agency. I do believe that there is a new era between the agencies. We are working, I believe, in concert with each other and cooperatively, I think, because we have the same common goal in mind, and that is to have competent, well-trained police officers who are ethical and professional in their decision-making. With respect to the board and policy committees, the board is a 24-member statutorily designated and appointed committee. Whose membership is appointed by the governor, and the members are confirmed by the Senate, with the exception of those individuals who are specifically named in statute, like the fire chief in Portland, the police chief in Portland, and the superintendent of the Oregon State Police and the director of the Department of Corrections. This full board meets quarterly. The executive committee of the board, which is comprised of the board chair and the policy committee board members, meets on a monthly basis, and they provide feedback to the agency on real-life training needs and industry needs throughout the state of Oregon. Also ensuring development of public safety officers who are, and this is a statutory citation, or the verbiage comes from the statute, culturally competent, ethically, physically, and emotionally fit, well-trained, highly skilled, and responsive to the needs of their communities. With respect to the constituent policy committees, there are 5 statutorily designated committees: police, fire, corrections, private security, which now includes private investigators, telecommunications, and there is an advisory committee dealing with polygraph licensing. These committees meet generally quarterly, but at the call of the chair, and can meet more frequently, and by statute can adopt or appoint subcommittees of their own committees to explore various issues and other things that might come before the board. They serve to work as work groups and discussion groups for agency policy and also rule updates, rule adoption, and various changes within the direction of the direction of the agency. They review discretionary revocation cases and make recommendations for action to the board. They create subcommittees and task force, I believe I mentioned that, for more in-depth discussion, research on specific topics, review and advise, and approve curriculum. And that's a bit of a change from the operation of the agency before I came there. Generally, the agency previously constructed the curriculum and then set it out, and it was what it was. It was like, you know, putting a certain dog food out. You either liked it or you didn't. If you didn't like it, that's too bad, because it's ours and you got to eat it. What we did is we gave the responsibility, I think appropriately, back to the board and the policy committees, because that's why they were created, with as discipline-specific policy committees, to help direct not only the issues of revocation, but also the future direction of the agency, and in particular, what is the curriculum, so that they have had a large hand and role in the development of the existing 16-week curriculum via curriculum review committees, and they will continue to have that role played throughout, hopefully, the future, as we evolve into necessary changes within the existing 16-week training program, or additional training that might be added in the future, either as an addendum to the 16-week training program within the confines of those 16 weeks, or as additional weeks that may be added in the future. With respect to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Trainings Organization, we are roughly 150.71 FTE, serving more than 35,000 public safety constituents during the 2005-2007 biennium. Governor's requested budget seeks an additional 29.54 FTE to facilitate enhanced complex scenario training, facilities, and services provided to constituents. There's an organization chart that just very roughly shows you how the department is divided up, and I believe the dotted boxes show you what the various packages are in our budget and the request within those particular packages. Glad to answer any questions a little later in the discussion. DPSST programs, we have the criminal justice program, and within that we have the standards and certification component, certification section, and records section. Training division has the academy training section, which includes the basic police, corrections, parole and probation, and instructor development components, including with the training division, regional and advanced training section. That includes leadership, regional, telecommunications, and child abuse. There's also a survival skills section within the training division that includes defense tactics, health and fitness, firearms and building searches. Tactical training section, which includes emergency vehicle operations. And what did I do with it? Scenario-based training and the training safety unit. One of the things that we're recognizing as we move into the complex scenario-based training that we are hoping will enhance the training and the competencies of the officers, the safety of the officers and safety of individuals who are participating is a very important component part. So we actually have a person who's designated to ensure and review the various scenarios for safety and hopefully ensure that we don't injure people in the process. Unfortunately, some states like Georgia have killed individuals on accident in training. We do not want to do that. Hence, that position is important. we also have a curriculum section within the training division that is broken into two different sections, testing and development. And there's also an academy operations section that is dealing mostly with the accommodation of officers coming into the academy. It's basically a hotel-motel function, if you will, giving them their uniforms as they come in, briefing them, giving them their meal cards, keys to their room, and generally helping them understand how to get in and out of the buildings and so on and so forth, and the security and some of the rules for participation in the program. Generally, the students will come, and they're required to come with a signed copy of the student conduct manual, which includes the parameters for entry and exit to the facility. Basically, the structure of the basic academy has changed. The gates close at 9:30 at night, and you're not allowed back on campus if you're not back on campus by 9:30 at night. We've decided we cannot control where they sleep or what they do, but we can control what goes on our campus. Our objective is to try to keep the students focused on their studies, keep them on campus, and hopefully keep them sober so they don't create problems for themselves and their agencies, which unfortunately some individuals are prone to do. We also have a fire program that includes the fire certification section and a fire training section that includes regional delivery programs and also local delivery program that is an intentional growth program located at the new facility. It includes a tactical tower that is set to burn with natural gas, and fire service organizations can come and do their exercises and training on site. We have the private security program, which includes the private investigator program and section and private investigator, so the investigators and private security. Excuse me, I botched my own notes. We also have the memorial fund, and then administration and support includes the director's office, human resources division, information services, business services, and facilities. With respect to revenue sources for the agency, one of our primary revenue sources is the criminal fines and assessment monies, which I referred to earlier, the fire insurance premium tax, which funds primarily the fire program, certificates of participation, which were a little bit, roughly $77.8 million, which were the dollars and the mechanism by which the new facility was constructed. Our authorization to expend COP proceeds expires June 30th of this year. We will be done completely with the project, and we will be on time under budget. And I hope if you have a chance to come out and see the facility, you'll be impressed. We're roughly at $185 per square foot for construction cost, which is virtually unheard of for most public programs. And I think we've got quite a bit for our dollars. We also have the 911 or 911 telephone excise tax, which I believe is up for reauthorization this session, which funds the telecommunications EMD program. Private security and private investigator programs are funded through fee-based programs specific to their organizations. Traffic safety is a training program that comes through a federal grant through the Department of Transportation, becomes other funds as it meanders through into our budget. We also have roughly 10 million dollars. That's right in the middle, I believe, of general funds, which the legislature last session chose to do the debt service for, the COP bonds from general fund as opposed to CFAA, and that that covers our funding sources. With respect to our performance measurement, the Oregon Progress Board measurements are generally, and I'll just go over these roughly, performance of officers upon completion of the academy, usefulness of regional training, usefulness of fire service training, revocations and denials that are upheld on appeal, professionalism of private security provider companies, and the accuracy and availability of officer records, and then customer service is a new KPM that was added during the last legislative session. With respect to anecdotal constituent feedback, we did recently and have consistently measured our success and how we're doing with our constituents by talking to them. We think that's pretty novel. We've just completed a 13-location listening tour around the state of Oregon, including all of the various disciplines, kind of going over the mountains and through the woods and through the snow and the ice and the sleet and the snow to visit with our constituents. They thought that was pretty nice because in many cases they come over to our site to do training and they go the other direction towards us and they go through the ice and the snow. But what we found, quite frankly, is that the constituents seem to be generally happy with the direction of the agency. They seem to believe that the customer service attitude and perspective has become rooted in the organization, and they seem generally complimentary. But they don't necessarily believe we're perfect either. So they do believe that there are things that we can do better, and the organization is striving to do so. We do, from time to time, receive compliments from constituents and from agencies, and from time to time we do get an occasional complaint where we don't lose as many reports or requests for documents that we as we used to. There's also a review of the director, me, the my performance in the statute under ORS that goes directly to the governor, and I'm reviewed by the board every year, and that review is submitted to the board. Lastly, outstanding issues. I just want to mention a couple of things that you'll probably hear in the three-day presentation that we're going to give at a later date. Some of our challenges and outstanding issues are meeting the demands of recruitment and retention of officers in general. I'll just cite that on a national level, the recruitment of police officers and public safety workers is becoming an acute problem. Fewer and fewer people are seeking public safety careers for any number of reasons, and there are a number of organizations, including the International Association of Chiefs of Police and the Department of Justice, U.S. Department of Justice, that are doing research to try to figure out why that is. But more recruitments are failing. More recruitments are unfortunately not generating the number of recruits. And as an example, when I was hired by the Portland Police Bureau, there were over 2,000 applicants for a few different positions. I think they hired 13 people out of that group, one of which was me. Today, if the Portland Police Bureau does a recruitment, they're lucky if they get 200 individuals applying for the position. So there is a huge problem that all public safety agencies are having with respect to recruitment. And it creates a conundrum for us because do you lower standards in order to bring people in, or do you keep the high standards and attract hopefully high-quality individuals who can be honest and have a high level of integrity? For the agency specific, the recruitment of subject matter experts who are competent and respected in their fields of work. Bottom line is, in order for us to hire people, we don't raise up puppy police officers or puppy corrections officers. We have to proselytize. We have to go to agencies like the Oregon State Police or Portland or other organizations and try to entice somebody to come to work for us because we value their expertise and the various skills that they've learned, and because they're going to be well respected within the classrooms and they're going to have credibility, if you will, in front of the classroom. That is a big issue before our department, and we're doing what we can, and actually I think we are doing a better job in within the customer service model. I do believe is actually facilitating that. Also, meeting the demand for higher standards, including professional and ethical decision making. You may have heard or read about a number of cases where individuals have made some serious errors in judgment for which their certifications have been revoked or in the process of being revoked. This is an area that sometimes becomes controversial, but unfortunately we have quite a number of chiefs of police whose certifications have been revoked, and sheriffs and others too. So it is unfortunately a problem that is a blight to law enforcement and public safety, and as I said earlier, the whole issue of standards is highly important to our agency because we are that enforcement agency, much like the Board of Medical Examiners or the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission as it relates to licensure and certification of police officers and corrections officers, etc. Continued pressure to increase basic training levels for all disciplines. This is something, as I mentioned earlier, we're now moving to a 16-week training program, and frankly, we're very fortunate to have the facility that we have, and we're very grateful that we have it. I think we actually have one of the best facilities in the nation outside of the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Flatsy, Georgia. There are a few other states, except perhaps Maryland, that have a facility like ours. I do believe it's becoming something that's being looked at as a model. I do know that it's becoming a model in terms of its physical structure with Edmonton, Canada, and the city of Edmonton. It's something, quite frankly, I think Oregonians can be very proud of, and I think the direction of the curriculum and where we're going with the conflict scenario-based training is also something to be very proud of because it's very innovative, and it also parallels the adult learning theory models and the capability of individuals to retain information compared to classroom training. Issues like, I'll add just a couple of things, mental health training and crisis intervention training are issues that come up constantly. Use of force, emotional survival of police officers. I mentioned, I think, 2 years ago in the legislative session that although the number of officers killed in the line of duty was pretty much static at roughly 150 officers each year in the United States are killed feloniously, there are roughly 600 or more who commit suicide. It continues to be a problem within the profession itself. The vocation. Issues of terrorism, both domestic and foreign terrorism, or local threats, threat assessment, and training in those areas are also desires for more competency levels. Organized crime and also special skills involving the use of bicycles, motorcycles, pit or pursuit intervention technique training. Defense tactics and growth in fire services, where most of the fire services training occurs in a regional environment with individuals who are working full-time and are part-time volunteer firefighters, and there is a void of defensive driving or emergency vehicle driver training that is one of the higher liability training venues for both fire and police, but primarily for fire, because they very infrequently have a chance to drive one of those big machines. And then other organizations like the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, Oregon University System, Oregon Health Sciences University, and other organizations that seek additional training for their professionals are from time to time knocking on our door wanting us to participate to help, and we're willing to do that, but it does add additional stresses to our program. I'll close by saying we're having our first Detective Academy in, I believe, June of this next year, inviting individuals from around the state to hopefully learn about investigative techniques and try to provide some uniform training for investigators throughout the state. And lastly, I do want to invite the committee to consider holding one or more of your committee meetings at our facility. We do have a fairly unique facility that would facilitate this, and I think would also help you understand a little bit more about what we're doing and why we're doing what we're doing. And why the venue is something that is not only a benefit to public safety training, but I think a benefit to other agencies around the state. In fact, we had the Department of Administrative Services conduct a customer service seminar for their own staff, I believe in about 350 in the morning and 350 in the afternoon in the multi-purpose room of the facility. So it's a great asset for the state of Oregon, and it's something I think that you'd all be proud of. With that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, thanks for your presentation, and it would be great to go out there if we could get in the cars and practice on the track.
Absolutely.
That would be fun.
More happy. I'm more than happy to do that.
On a more serious note, in the training, I know here in Marion County, the sheriffs are trying to go through, I think, a full 40-hour week of mental health recognition training, and in the program, is there a move towards that at the basic level, or can you talk a little bit about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, yes, I can, and thank you very much for the question. It's interesting because I didn't plant the question, but I was actually just working on this very topic before I came over here. In the 10-week basic training program, we had 3 hours of classroom training. That was the entirety of the mental health training. In the 16-week program, it moves to 12 hours of classroom training and then moves into the complex scenario-based training, which increases that training or applies that training in a practical setting anywhere between 6 to an additional 12 hours of training, excuse me, 10 hours of training. So it gets us partway there. It builds a foundation within the basic training program for public safety officers. It does not get us to a 40-hour crisis intervention training program like the Memphis model, which is also, I think, the program and model that the city of Portland just recently, through Mayor Potter, mandated that all Portland police officers were going to take. The advice that I've given the governor's office and my agency has landed on with respect to training police officers, all police officers in crisis intervention training, is that if you go back and look at the Memphis model, the problem with training everyone is you get individuals who are trained but not necessarily interested in or competent in doing crisis intervention training. And it's a fundamental problem having individuals who really don't care being taught to do something that they don't care to do. So in the Memphis model, they actually went out and recruited individuals that really want to be and are caring about involving themselves in dealing with de-escalation techniques and crisis intervention training, and then taught those individuals and then carried on consistent ongoing training in the past. So our recommendation, quite frankly, to the governor's office would be that our organization participate in regional training for crisis intervention training to individuals who've been specifically recruited for that very purpose. The other component part that's very important is that it has to be connected to the community and community resources. If it's training just for training purposes, but it's not connected to the local mental health facilities or the local hospitals or the local practitioners, or even if you don't have buy-in from the local police department or corrections department, it's not going to be successful. I think it has to be more of a multidisciplinary model, and that's the advice and counsel we've gotten from documentation from both the National Institute of Corrections and from the individuals who've been running the Memphis model.
Thank you.
Senator Brown.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I may have missed it, John, but status of multicultural curriculum in your training program, is it happening?
Well, it is. I don't know that I have the comparison of multicultural training, but there is a substantial component part of the training that deals with multicultural training and diversity, if you will, under that topic. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Nickinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. I will want to discuss at some time the financial models, how it works to do training provided by the state, and then also understanding that local governments, cities and counties, then some of them have identified the need to do training beyond the basic training.
Absolutely.
So what are the costs? What are the costs for the locals as well as the state to use to follow the method that we follow now? We have a tremendous investment now in a centralized basic program, but then there's still money spent on top of that. And now we see cities and counties really strapped. So I'm going to want to know more about that. And the other thing I wanted to ask about, this is a great matrix, by the way, and I was glancing at it while you were talking. There are some valued employees that we have at the state as well as local level who we ask them to put themselves in harm's way potentially every day. They're not on the list that I see yet, so far for assistance with either training or curriculum development. I'm thinking about building inspectors, for example. I did a ride-along with the building inspector, and that can be a pretty dicey situation. Do you ever get requests, or do you do some training for other categories of public employees who might need assistance? I noticed that there are some on here, for example, Oregon Humane Society enforcement agents, Liquor Control Commission agents. There are some people who we don't traditionally think of. It's not cops, for example. Mm-hmm. But I can think of other categories who maybe could use some assistance.
Great. Mr. Chairman and Representative Nathanson, thank you very much for both of the questions. And I want to make it, I perhaps didn't make it very clear, that we do have a regional component to our training program. We have five regional training coordinators around the state that do facilitate training in the various skills. And you also have local jurisdictions who also try to carry out various training. And the key to that is it depends on how much money they have or how many resources they have locally. So if you go to the Portland Police Bureau or you go to Eugene or Salem or anywhere in the Willamette Valley, you go to Bend, Redmond, because they're larger organizations with more people and perhaps more resources, you're probably going to find a higher level of training and training involvement. That would be the same for sheriff's departments too. But the misnomer is the vast majority of police agencies are very small organizations with budgets between $500,000 to $1.5 million, and maybe two or three people, maybe four, working for them, maybe one or two full-time paid employees and a number of reserve officers and some support staff. So that's really the reason we exist, and that's really the reason the regional training program is there, is we are the regional training program for the vast majority of small agencies, both for police and fire around the state of Oregon. And it really is a critical component part of what we do. And I want to just underline this one point, if I can, and that is perishable skills. You'll hear me say that a lot as we get into the three-week program. Many of the skills, like emergency vehicle operations training, defense tactics, use of firearms, decision-making, these kind of things, are perishable skills. If you don't use them, you'll lose them. So you have to have ongoing skills that are reinforced over time. And you also have new techniques and new technologies that are applied from time to time, and those kind of trainings also need to. With respect to training other state agency individuals, we actually have a seminar today and yesterday at our facility, which is the Child Abuse Training Seminar. I don't know if you're familiar with SCARS, Jasper Mountain. It was a program that was held in Eugene. That program is now defunct. It doesn't exist anymore. Our agency has taken that on, and the Department of Human Resource employees, some of them are currently present in that training, child abuse basic training, familiarization with burns and other kinds of abuse problems, etc. We haven't gotten into building inspectors. I think Corey Streisinger, the director of the Building Business Services Division, might be a little bit concerned about that. Although she may be willing to give it to me. I don't know. We probably trade them back and forth because they do have challenges just like we do. They're very similar component parts. And, you know, given the resources and given the opportunity to work in partnership, I think there are some opportunities that will present themselves in the future where those kind of organizations may be able to access some general seminar training and this kind of thing, leadership training, executive development, leadership, and other kind of officer safety issues. We haven't got that far yet. We're not that mature yet. But
thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I appreciate your time today.
All right, the next portion will be the Oregon Military Department, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell and Major General Fred Reese.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Good afternoon. I am Major General Fred Reese, the Adjutant General of Oregon. And with me today is Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. As always, we are extremely grateful for the opportunity to provide you an overview of the Oregon National Guard, and we have provided some handout slides for review. And as we've been advised, in the essence of time, we want to keep remarks here to kind of an overarching overview level. Charts 2, 3, and 4 there talk to our statutory mission, our constitutional role, and have a mission statement there. Mission is straightforward: provide the citizens of the state of Oregon and the United States with ready force of citizen soldiers and airmen equipped and trained to respond to any contingency, natural or man-made. When we are needed, we are there. We are, as I've already stated, we're the U.S. Constitution, Oregon Constitution, Oregon Revised Statutes. Chart 5 demonstrates that we are a unique organization of nearly 9,000 Oregonians who are citizen soldiers and airmen and civilian, federal, and state employees. Over 2,200 soldiers, airmen, and civilians work full-time for the Oregon Guard and the Oregon Military Department. The Oregon National Guard and the Oregon Military Department is supported primarily by federal funds. Close to 95% of the Oregon Military Department's total budgeted funds are federal funds. 4% comes to the Oregon Military Department as general fund, and 1% is generated as other funds. When I was first appointed as the Adjutant General in 1987, the state share was closer to 10% of the budget. Chart 6 speaks to the mix of full-time employees that we have. The majority of our state employees are working in programs that exist through federal and state cooperative agreements, wherein the military department, acting on behalf of the state of Oregon, enters into a contractual relationship with the National Guard Bureau, serving on behalf of the federal government. Only 10% of the state employees are fully supported by state general fund, and the remainder are either fully funded by federal dollars or by mixed funding of state and federal dollars. Chart 7 talks to monetary efficiencies. We believe that this efficiency adds a great value to Oregon. Federal dollars pay taxable income to our soldiers, airmen, and federal civilian employees, generating Oregon tax revenue almost double the amount received by the Oregon Military Department in budgeted general fund dollars. Our federal and state public contracts and purchases with local vendors support Oregon-based businesses, which also generate a substantial economic and tax-received impact. Chart 8 is basically our organization. My agency consists of the Joint Forces Headquarters, the Military Department, the Army Guard, the Air Guard, and the State Defense Force. Not depicted here is the Office of Emergency Management, and I'll talk to that more as we go through this hearing today. Recently, the governor moved the operational control of the Office of Emergency Management to the Military Department with the expectation that the legislature will codify this move in this session. Looking at our command structure, we have the governor, my office, the Joint Force Headquarters, and the subordinate commands. The Air Guard has two major commands with the 142nd Fighter Wing at the Portland Air Base, the 173rd Fighter Wing at Kingsley Field in Klamath Falls, and even though both of these units fly the F-15 jet, they have distinctly different missions. The 142nd is an operational wing that is 24/7, 365 days a year, responsible for the air sovereignty from the Canadian border across Washington, Oregon, and into Northern California. We keep F-15s on alert every day of the year at the Portland Air Base, and this mission is under the control of the North American Aerospace Air Defense Command in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Also in Portland, we have a combat communication squadron, a weather flight, medical and logistics organizations, and a special tactics squadrons, which is the Air Force version of special operations. As Mike Caldwell here would point out, this organization has a multitude of capabilities, including jumping out of perfectly good airplanes, and they would probably provide the basis for a good Hollywood action movie. But for you folks, I think the more important thing, what you see in around the state, those people were at this most recent search and rescue episode at Mount Hood, where they were providing communications capabilities to the sheriff of Hood River County. We anticipate a moderate growth of 100 drill status positions in the near future at Portland Air National Guard Base. We're pleased with that. At Kingsley Field at Klamath Falls, we have the 173rd Fighter Wing with its primary responsibility to train F-15 pilots for the Air Guard and the Air Force. This base is perfectly situated to allow a maximum number of flying days over designated flying areas in southeastern Oregon. The schoolhouse requirement also demands a higher number of full-time personnel than the average National Guard fighter wing, which also helps the community greatly with respect to economics. We are pleased to report to you a significant growth of between 90 and 100 full-time positions in the very near future in this activity, and we will continue to be one of the top three economic engines for that region of the state. We also have an air control squadron at this base that provides air traffic control for the Klamath Falls Airport. On the Army side of the house, we have two major subordinate commands, the 41st Brigade and the 82nd Brigade. The 41st Brigade consists of approximately 3,500 soldiers and is primarily distributed over western Oregon. This brigade is currently deployed with nearly 900 of its members in Afghanistan, where they are training the Afghan National Army, and they are known as Joint Task Force Phoenix. We anticipate their return in June of this year. And I would tell you they are doing an absolutely outstanding job. The 82nd Brigade has units in eastern Oregon, Portland, and the Willamette Valley. This brigade is a command and control element that has roughly 3,000 soldiers with a wide variety of skills. It includes an armor battalion in eastern and central Oregon, an engineer battalion with headquarters in Salem, support units at Camp Withicum in Clackamas, and the aviation battalion here in Salem and Pendleton. The subordinate units of this brigade will have a multitude of capabilities that provide the state with communications, transportation, aviation and logistics for an emergency. Also in this command, I have the State Defense Force, which we are in the process of reorganizing to place them in every command in the state and be the face that all county emergency managers become familiar with so that they can liaise between military and local emergency management agencies. This group of volunteers consists primarily of former guardsmen and women who desire to continue their service to their community while at the same time provide us the wisdom and experience needed to bridge the gap between civilian and military issues. This is a work in progress and one we will continue to improve on as we move into the emergency management business with the Office of Emergency Management. This brief overview of the command structure of the Oregon National Guard and this organization demonstrates our tremendous capability and our deep bench that we can face a wide variety of missions that may be thrown at us. Charts 9 and 10. Many factors influence the ability of our forces to meet today's increasing demands. Infrastructure and facilities are increasingly important. In the state-federal relationship, it is the primary responsibility of the governor to command this force while in a peacetime or training status. It is also the state's responsibility to provide for the administration and the housing of the National Guard. Our facilities are of primary importance to us and provide the base for which all these soldiers and airmen learn their craft and sustain those skills while in state status. To accomplish this, we have 40 armories, 2 air bases, 4 training camps, and the Youth Challenge site. We are the third largest agency in square footage in state government. Over the past decade and a half, we have struggled to maintain these aging facilities, and today, the majority of them do not meet the standards set forth by the National Guard Bureau. Many of our Oregon National Guard facilities are well past their useful life. Inadequate facilities impact both the training and quality of life of our members as well as drain valuable resources. Our facilities have to reflect the developing roles and missions for increased Oregon National Guard participation in both global warfare and homeland security. We need to ensure decision makers know and understand the value of our infrastructure for both the homeland security and the wartime mission. As you can see by the handout, we are well placed in every region of the state to provide a complete network of facilities and capabilities to respond to any man-made or natural disaster. Chart 11. Nearly every generation in Oregon history can attest to the significant contribution our citizen soldiers and airmen and their families have made in defense of our freedoms and our way of life. In fact, if we look at the militia concept in this continent, the militia predates our country and our Constitution by well over 100 years, dating back to 1636. Long before September 11, 2001, the Oregon National Guard, both at home and abroad, has served this great state and nation. The past 15 years, the Oregon National Guard has contributed forces, equipment, and people to Operations Desert Shield and Desert Storm, patrolled the no-fly zones for Operations Southern and Northern Watch, served in the stabilization operations in Bosnia, and performed as peacekeeping forces in the Sinai. We have also maintained our state-to-state partnerships, responded to domestic emergencies, performed humanitarian and security operations in the aftermath of devastating hurricanes on the Gulf Coast, and assisted in numerous search and rescue efforts in the western United States. In Chart 12, we talk to deployments. Over the last 5 years and today, the Oregon National Guard has deployed citizen soldiers and airmen to dangerous and austere conditions in places such as Afghanistan, Iraq, and Southwest Asia, where they conduct ground, air, and space combat operations in support of the global war on terror. Where the nation goes, the Oregon National Guard will go with it. The Oregon National Guard has the will. We need the sustaining resources for our people and their families, including continued efforts in assisting them with reintegration back into family, community, and career after returning home from mobilizations. Since September 11, 2001, we have deployed 7,350 soldiers and airmen to federal active duty. We have two deployments scheduled this summer of approximately 200 soldiers. They will be going to Iraq. The Oregon National Guard is present for duty, bringing great skills, talent, and capabilities to bear in an increasingly dangerous world. Oregon National Guard units under control of the governor and the adjutant general will be the first military responders on the scene of any local event, first military responder. We have a civil support team that was certified by the Secretary of Defense in this last year. Consists of 22 full-time National Guardsmen and state-of-the-art capabilities to go in and assist first responders in any community in the state, identify and analyze any chemical, biological, or nuclear event that may occur. They're a very, very capable group of people. One of the most important lessons the legislative leaders can take away from the recent past and today is a fuller appreciation of the adaptability and ability to react quickly provided by the Oregon National Guard. The governor has placed the Oregon Emergency Management and a portion of the Criminal Justice Services Division under the Adjutant General for operational control as this legislature considers Governor Kulongoski's proposal to permanently move this office under the military department. I believe this action will assist us in preparation, response, and recovery when we are faced with a disaster. Not only will this action create a seamless organization for response, but it will also align us with the other northwestern states. Washington, Idaho, Montana, and Alaska all have this same construct. Given our most recent experience in Hurricane Katrina, it is clear that this model is a very effective and efficient way to deal with disasters. With the increased number of call-ups, we have discovered that in a large sense, we have not been organized or manned at the appropriate levels to meet these challenges. We have adjusted and sought additional resources from the National Guard Bureau. In most cases, we have been able to fully meet the challenges. The exception to this has been the creation of the reintegration team established and funded in the October 2005 Emergency Board. I'm happy to report that our program is now being copied nationwide, and I am hopeful we will see federal funding to continue this vital asset in the next year or two. In the meantime, I have submitted in the governor's budget a continued funding request, and I'm hopeful you will continue this vital program for our returning National Guardsmen. The Oregon legislature has codified incentives for service relating to property taxes, income taxes, education benefits, emergency relief assistance, and the reimbursement of resident hunting and angling licenses. And for this, we are very grateful. You will see some fixes that are being proposed this session, as we have found some problems in our attempt to fully realize the legislative intent. In charts 13 and 14, I provided you charts depicting the chain of command previously. These charts also provide you a budget chart of how the budget is organized for the military department and our performance measures. If I have a weakness in my organization, it would be in my equipment availability. The global war on terror has caused us to deploy our best equipment with our soldiers, most of which did not return from the war zone. To date, I am at approximately 40% of my required levels. Congress has taken steps to fix this problem, but it has taken a long time to get these items to Oregon, and I don't foresee them being reestablished for at least 12 to 24 months, if then. The leadership in our Oregon National Guard is strong, our personnel ready, and our missions relevant. Whether at home or deployed, fighting the global war on terror or securing the safety of Oregonians through homeland security efforts, the Oregon National Guard is performing our mission daily. With proper resources of people, facilities, and equipment, we will always be there when our nation and state calls. As the late Congressman Sonny Montgomery repeatedly said, this nation would be nearly paralyzed by various crises if the Guard did not exist. We don't intend to not be there whenever we're required to be there. Together, we can lead our Oregon National Guard toward the future with determination and vision, but it must be one that is well thought out, resourced, and maintains the relevance and spirit of the National Guard and the citizen, soldier, and airman. I thank you for this opportunity to provide you an overview of the Oregon Guard and the Oregon Military Department. I'd be happy to take your questions, and either General Caldwell or I will attempt to answer them. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. The moving of the Office of Emergency Management, has there been any consideration of moving the Owen project along with that? I mean, it seems like they all fit together. I hadn't thought about that before until you made your presentation. They should all be together.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, yes, there has been some thought given to that, but with the size and scope of the Owen project, the startup requirements and so on, it would appear that it's going to be much better to have a focused effort as a separate entity. Mike, do you have a further comment on that?
I would say that I think that pretty much covers it. I think it would be a mistake to try to move it to us at this point in the game.
Just one final comment for me. I think that particularly today, the 800-pound gorilla in the room is the war in Iraq, and I don't care how you feel. All of us feel about the war. All of us support the troops and want to do everything we possibly and humanly can to make sure that they're safe while they're over there. And so I didn't give you this question beforehand, so I don't want an answer now, but when you come back, I'd like you to just answer the question in your opinion on whether or not we as a state are doing everything we can to make sure that our troops have what they need and what it would take to ensure their safety with every degree possible.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Close this committee. Thank you.
Thank you.